They were old friends, the Tex Goldschmidts. He'd spent a year or two in Iran on social and economic work. And one of my beautification benefactors, the Ralph Beckers, who also, happily, is president of the Iran-America Society. The two loveliest ladies there were B.A. Benson of Texas and Mrs. Frances Lawrence, Iranian-born, absolutely stunning, who swooped in a deep curtsy when she met the Shah. And there were the Julius Holmes, the ambassador who was in Iran when we were there, and a perfect prototype of an ambassador. And two of our staff members who had accompanied us there, Liz Carpenter and Bill Crockett. Then I had Philip Johnson, the architect, at her table, and thought him the most interesting man at the party. And the John Walkers, in whose lovely National Gallery of Art, the wonderful Iranian exhibit had been held several years ago, reminisced with the Shah about that. Lee Udall sat next to the Shah. She and Stu had been to Iran, and she is young and bright. And I had carefully put David Lilienthal close to me into the Shah because one of my really inspiring memories of a chief of state was when I sat next to the Shah at a visit to his country, and he told me about the development of the rivers, the hydroelectric power, the possibilities for irrigation, for flood control, and described David Lilienthal's work with so much personal admiration. I'd put young Mrs. Roy Hoffines, Jr. at my table, too. Roy, I had found to be almost a replica of the young Roy Hoffines who'd managed Lyndon's campaign for the Senate in 1941 in Houston. His father had proudly told me that he spoke, I believe it was, 11 languages, had gotten his Ph.D. when he was 19, and was now teaching at Harvard. I asked his wife about him, and she said rather deprecatingly that it was really just 7 languages. And what did he teach? It was Chinese politics. What a long way. What a great American story. I remember meeting his grandmother in that campaign in 41, a woman of very simple and modest origins, so new to America, her German accent so thick that I could hardly understand her English. We began with Striped Bass Isfahan, named after one of the Shah's cities, and ended with a really glorious dessert, August Basket, the first that Ferdinand has concocted since he got back from the hospital. Lyndon's toast was eloquent and had a touch of humor. He spoke of how much the company missed the Empress. This administration champions beauty in all its forms. And about the Shah's approaching coronation, it will be in October, after he has reigned for 26 years. Lyndon said, I must add special congratulations on Your Majesty's superb sense of timing. You have had the foresight to schedule your coronation when your polls are up. Once more, the Shah made his response without notes, slowly, rather hesitantly, but with a very winning quality. He spoke of why the Empress had remained at home. She has many things to do. For the first time, a woman is to be crowned in our country. Lately, women have achieved many rights, though whether that is equality in wearing a crown, I don't know. His voice rather slurred off in a very amusing manner. I have the feeling he's becoming more mature, more used to power, more at home with humor, and there's a wonderful quality of humility in him. And of course he quite won me when he paid me a more than token compliment. Mrs. Johnson is doing so much for the betterment of so many things. He outlined briefly the improvements in his country, and especially in the last 5 years. I think all of the guests were as captivated with him as I was. One of the surprising things he had said at dinner was that he was planning a green belt around Tehran, where absolutely every tree had to be watered to grow. But he thought it would be such a great ornament to the capital of his country, and they were going to do it. We had coffee in the Red Room, and guests came up to chat with them, Betty Beale among them. I'd invited Marilyn Walsh to the after-dinner entertainment with her date, who turned out to be quite handsome. It always makes me feel so good to have young people enjoy and appreciate these White House entertainments. She is a fresh mixture of reserve and enthusiasm that I find engaging. The Claiborne Pells had brought their young house guest, Prince Philip Liechtenstein, to the 10 o'clock entertainment. And of course, the press fell upon that title with relish. And Agnes DeMille's son, Jonathan Prude, was there, and Mary Slater and Warren Lynn, of course, and Marie and John Criswell, and Nash Castro's daughter, Kim, and Christy Carpenter. We try especially to remember the children of friends for the 10 o'clock entertainment, especially when we have a group of entertainers like tonight's, who are themselves so young and gay. Lyndon has worked so hard these last days and weeks, and he's weary and was ready to get the entertainment on the road. So as soon as we could gracefully, for what turned out to be one of the gayest, bounciest, liveliest evenings of entertainment I remember. The American Ballet Theater, directed by Lucia Chase, putting on a ballet called Rodeo. It was introduced by its own choreographer, Agnes DeMille, with her remarkable sparkle and wit. To me, she's as good an actress as a choreographer. And the cowgirl and square dancers, and ranch owner's daughter and Eastern friends, in their old-fashioned costumes, and the wrangler and the roper and the cowboys, in their blue jeans and big hats, and kind of boots that you could do ballet in, were so light and lively, so much fun, that I had that satisfied feeling any hostess has when she knows things are going well. We took the Shah up on the stage with us after it was over, met and thanked all the young people, and there were lots of pictures. And then we walked with him to the North Portico for a rather early goodbye. It wasn't 12 yet. Lyndon went straight upstairs. I stayed another 45 minutes or so, talking to the young dancers, and Agnes DeMille especially, and Armand Hammer, who told me the marvelous news that he wanted to give the White House a Russell bronze. He knew we had a Remington one. I struggled with myself one moment and then said, "You're testing my loyalty." And he said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "You know, there'll be a Lyndon Johnson library within just 2 or 3 years. And the artists of the Southwest are among my husband's favorites. It will be marvelous for the White House to have it." But I got no farther. He said, "I'll give something to the Lyndon Johnson Library, too." And then he went on something about the original of The Cowboy in Bronze by Russell. What a great addition those would be. I'm always pleased to see him because I remember our pleasant encounter at Campo Bello and his generosity and forethought, his lasting love of a man in preserving FDR's old summer home as a park where everybody can come. I saw David Lilienthal in the hall and said, "Come with me." I wanted to talk to him about his time in Iran, and I started into the red parlor, and lo and behold, when I looked over my shoulder, he was not there. I felt exactly like the little cowgirl in the ballet who couldn't get a man for the first two acts. It was really funny. Later in the evening, I got a second chance. I met him face to face and straightway admitted, "I'd wanted to talk to you. What happened to you?" He said something quite graceful about, "I really couldn't believe I'd heard you right." And we went in the green room and had a very fascinating interlude of the kind of conversation that makes an evening remembered. Yes, he was full of hope about the work that he'd done in Iran and about their future and about their ability to handle it, to take over. We talked of Korea's progress. And then I said, "What are you doing now?" He looked at me rather wryly and said something like this, "A very persuasive man has put me to work in Vietnam." And then I remembered Lyndon, either seeing him on his trip to Guam or right thereafter, and thrilling sounding plans for things that could be done, the agriculture for the economy of the country. He talked about the Vietnamese. He said they were very hard workers and very quick to learn. Best of all, he sounded full of hope that was based on knowledge and work. And he sounded like he liked my husband. It was after 12 o'clock when I went to the second floor with our house guests, the Marshall Steves and S.B. Whittington and the young Dick Browns, to have a nightcap. And Lyndon called us from his room while he was ensconced in bed, half covered with memoranda and reports. He said, "Come on in and have your drink with me." So we piled up in the few chairs and on the floor and talked of Amarilla and Hemisphere and Austin, the Dick Browns say everybody likes Pat so much, and of all the things Texas ought to do as a state to get ready for Hemisphere. I was still shaken by the perfection of Expo and so concerned about Texas' place in the eyes of the world if we have all of those thousands of visitors next year. Patsy is delightful. She straightforwardly told Lyndon something I like for him to hear. "Mr. President, if the whole country could see you informally when you just talk off the cuff, they'd understand you and they'd be with you." It was 1 o'clock when we went to bed, and I chalked it up as a good day, a successful state visit with one of the most fascinating and likable monarchs I'll ever meet. Something less than the most glittering assemblage of guests. An A-plus entertainment.